Praise the Lord. We are going through the book of Proverbs here and discussing the various characters that are there. There's a bunch of characters. We're characters, aren't we? The real characters. People are interesting. People are funny. And we're talking about the sluggard. Remember what the Hebrew root word comes from? It comes from the root meaning to lean. To lean. The sluggard is the one always leaning. You can tell a sluggard he's leaning against a post over there, against the wall somewhere. And we are looking at scriptures describing the sluggard. The last point we were at was in chapter 21, verses 25 and 26. And this is under a section discussing how the reason why he's a sluggard is because he's full of the lust of the flesh. And his lusting takes away his foresight and industriousness. All he cares about is immediate fun in the flesh. And so he's not diligently working ahead in the future. In verse chapter 21, 25, and 26, the desire of the slothful kills him, for his hands refuse to labor. And if he didn't care about it, then it wouldn't kill him. But he sits there, lusts. And the more he lusts, the less he wants to work to get it, because there's another lust, and that is his ease. And so he's lusting after the benefits of labor, but he lusts also after the ease. And so his desire kills him, because he's unwilling to get it, and so he can't have it, and yet he still wants it. And so the slugger gets eaten up inside. He covets greedily all the day long, but the righteous gives and spares not. Now the righteous, just on the opposite end, he's giving and he's diligent and he's working and he's providing, but he's not consuming it on his own lusts. When he gets, he gives. And so he's pouring it out. So he's moving in to get it, and then he's pouring it out. It's like the person that they want the love of God, but they're unwilling to labor to get it. Mm-hmm. They're unwilling to press in. They're unwilling to move into the move of God. You know, and they want the love of God, and so the desire kills them. Mm-hmm. But the righteous presses in, receives the love of God, but turns around and gives it. And he's just pouring it out and pouring it out and pouring it out. See? That's the righteous. Thirdly, about the sluggard, his life ends up full of pain and constant heartache. Full of pain and constant heartache. In chapter 15 and verse 19, it says, the way of the slothful man is as a hedge of thorns, but the way of the righteous is made plain. He's got a plain path, easy to walk in. The way of the slothful is a hedge of thorns. Every step he takes creates him pain. He doesn't want to step because he's lazy. But he has to step because of his, you know, he's got this desire, and it doesn't matter what he puts himself to, he's always dissatisfied, and so his life is a hedge of thorns. Now understand how a hedge of thorns is made. They would pile up, to make a wall, they would pile up rocks out there in the field. Maybe it'd get 3-4 foot high, you know, something like that. And then on the top of that thing, they'd take these wilderness thorn bushes, and they'd weave these thorn bushes together, and they were tough, and the thorns on them were 3 to 4 inches long. And they're like nails. They use them like nails, and they use them like needles. They're very solid, very strong. There was trees back in Michigan that I used to try to climb that had some like that. You got to be really careful when you climb them. And those thorns, they were like wood, you know, only they had the hard casing on them. And so they were, you know, you could drive them right through you. Well, these thorns would actually even keep wolves out of the sheepfold. And you know, a wolf, a dog, I mean, he's not going to be easily frightened away by something. And so you've got this rock wall, and then you've got this hedge of thorns. Well, his way is like a hedge of thorns. Because he's always dissatisfied. He's always discontent. Everything he does brings him more pain. The slothful man. Fourthly, we see that the slothful man is a coward. He's a coward. He's afraid of putting himself out. He's afraid of self-denial. It's a pain to him to think of denying himself, because he just wants everything now. He's selfish, and that's what's made him slothful. He doesn't want to work to get it. He just wants it handed to him. Chapter 22 and verse 13. The slothful man says, there is a lion without. I shall be slain in the streets. Now, what does this mean? Here is a city. And for some reason, the lion is, you know, upset or whatever, and he's, because there are lions all around there, but they'd stay generally in the hedges, you know, they'd stay off in the brush. A lion has come into the city. And so the cry goes out, there's a lion in the streets. And what does the righteous man do? He says, I shall slay him. I shall drive him from the city.
What does the sluggard say?
I shall die in the streets.
Why? Either because he's too lazy to rush into his house and get safety, and he's certainly not willing to risk his own life. He's a sluggard. He's not willing to put himself out. See, the sluggard has no pioneer spirit. He's not one of the pioneers, for sure. There's a fear in him to launch out. He doesn't want to launch out. He doesn't want to try something just to see what'll happen, because it might take some work. There's no real deep faith in a sluggard. He's not willing to launch out against the devil, because there might be some damage inflicted in this thing. He's unwilling to face the lion face to face. And therefore, he has a lot of fancied fears. A lot of fancied fears. And his mind conjures up a lot of negative results and responses. He sees a situation, and instead of building up in his mind faith and victory and getting some sort of plan together and getting all the men together and chasing down this lion, he fancies in his mind death. Problems, difficulty, hardship. And it causes him to back off. And that's what the sluggard is like. Let's look at another description of the sluggard. It's a longer description found in chapter 26, verses 13 through 16. The slothful man says, there is a lion in the way. A lion is in the streets. Full of fears, but he won't do anything about it. Because he doesn't want to have to put up. He's a sluggard. I have to admit that whenever I go over this area, I often think of one person that I knew who was a sluggard. Everything was a pain. Everything was a pain, you know. I felt so sorry for the guy. He had a real heart for the Lord. He really did. He really loved Jesus. But he was a sluggard. And it was so difficult for him to try anything. It was difficult to get a devotional time, difficult to keep his prayer time, difficult to go witnessing. Everything was a difficulty. Because he wouldn't just launch out and do what he knew to do. He would mull over in his mind all the possibilities. Oh, you know, it's going to take work, and what if I fail, and what if I don't follow through, and all these fancied fears just get built up in his mind to where he wouldn't do anything. He just hang back. And it showed everywhere. It showed in his job, it showed in his prayer life, it showed in spiritual areas, it showed in everything. And it was because of selfishness, basic selfishness. Well, he went through some hard knocks, and he's gotten mainly free from it now. But, oh, wow, did he ever have to walk on some thorns before he got free from, you know? Your freedom is a horrible thing. Lions in the streets. Verse 14, as the door turns upon his hinges, so doth a slothful upon his bed. How does the door turn upon his hinges? Slow and without accomplishment. Just, what good does it do? You know, just back and forth. And that's how he turns on his bed. He doesn't want to get out of bed because he might have to do something. And so he lies in his bed full of terror about all the things he might have to do. You know, he wastes away. His whole life is a hedge of thorns. It's no good to be a slothful person. You just got to get out there and go to it, see? Look at this next verse. The slothful man hides his hand in his bosom. It grieves him to bring it again to his mouth. Now, the bosom here is literally dish. He puts his hand into the dish. He's at the dinner table. He puts his hand into the dish, but it grieves him to bring it to his mouth. What is this saying? And you know, I think he's more using this as an illustration, because I'm pretty sure the slothful man probably eats well, but, you know. What it's saying is this. Here's a dish, and it's a good endeavor to put your hand into the dish. They eat with their hands, you know. It's a good endeavor to put your hand into the dish to eat. And he starts good endeavors, but it's a grief to him to follow through with anything. And you see, you can start it, but brethren, the starting of it is not the fruit of it. It's the ending of it that's the fruit of it. And so it's not that you bring it back to your mouth and taste of it that you get the fruit of it. Well, the slothful man, he'll jab at something, but it's a grief to him to have to follow through and carry it through, you know, because it's difficult. It's hard. Now it's going to cost him something. He felt like doing it at first, but now he doesn't feel like doing it. And so it's a grief to him to bring it back into his mouth. This is a sluggard. And he's too lazy to apply the needed effort to get the benefit out of his job. It's a grief to him. And the Hebrew here means it makes him tired or makes him disgusted. That's exactly what happens to the sluggard. It's tiring and disgusting to him to have to put such effort into these things. Then verse 16. The sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than seven men that can render a reason. Why? Because he's got to make sure he's got rationale for what he's doing. So he's wiser in his own conceit. He'll sit there and he'll tell you why it's fine for him to roll over and over on his bed. That kind of guy has got to be, he's got to treat himself stiffly. He's got to be stiff with himself to get himself out of there. He's got to go to this ant. He's got to watch that ant until it wears him to pieces, you know. Until it wears him out watching those diligent ants. And he needs to go to the diligent man and ask him, what should I do? But he's got to break out of that pattern, and it's going to cost him something. It's going to be hard on him. But he's got to just break through it and do it and break that pattern so he can begin to get free from his slothfulness. Okay, the sixth person we want to talk about is the wicked man. Now, I want to look at chapter 6, verses 12 to 15. We're talking about one who is definitely wicked. In his heart is a root of wickedness, just like the devil. Chapter 6, 12 to 15. A naughty person, a wicked man, walks with a froward or a perverse mouth. This word naughty person in the Hebrew is literally Adam Belial, a man of Belial. And Belial means worthlessness, without profit. And it's talking about a man who is not of any benefit to God and he's not of any benefit to man. You know what a horrible state to be in, to be a wicked man. You're no benefit to God and you're no benefit to man. This is the kind of one talked about in the New Testament that's made to be taken and destroyed. Made to be taken and destroyed. The word wicked here is interesting in the Hebrew. It comes from the root word meaning to pant. And it basically means nothing. Nothingness. Nothingness. It's interesting that God views wickedness as nothingness. It's the absence of life. It's the absence of good. It's things that produce no benefit. Now, this is a less common word for the word wicked. The more common word is the word rasha, which means badness or wrongness or even violation. We see that word in chapter 4, verse 14. Enter not into the path of the wicked, the rasha. Is bad or one who violates or is violated. Well, he speaks with a froward mouth. Now, the word froward here literally means twisted, therefore perverse, or distorted, or deceitful. The wicked person, he can't talk straight. He's like the devil. He's like the devil. He can't talk straight. Everything is twisted. It's twisted around in his head and therefore in his mouth. Now, what is he like? Verse 13, he winks with his eyes, he speaks with his feet, he teaches with his fingers. Now, what is this? The basic overall concept here is deception. That's the basic overall concept. See, he's not doing things straightforwardly. He's deceiving. Winking with his eyes. This probably is referring to a malicious deceit. It represents ulterior motives. Ulterior motives. Have you ever seen somebody who's maybe there's three people in a group, two guys that are wicked and one guy that's kind of naive, and he looks at this naive guy and he says, "Sir, I'll help you get to the railroad station." And actually he's going to abduct him or something. "Sir, I'll help you get to the railroad station." And he looks over at his buddy and he winks. He winks with his eyes. He's got ulterior motives. We see the same thing used in Job 15 verses 11 through 13. It's to treat a thing lightly. It's a winking with the eye. It's an ulterior motive. And the wicked has an ulterior motive. It says he speaks with his feet. This is probably referring to making signs with your feet that the person you're talking to cannot see, but you're actually instructing an accomplice. For instance, if you're talking to somebody and you want your accomplice to come up behind him and get behind his legs, then you'll push him back over and he'll fall. You know? And so you're talking to him and you're making movements with your feet. And the movements with your feet tell this buddy of yours to come up and to kneel behind this guy, and then you push him and boom, over he falls. See? So he speaks with his feet. So it's deceit. And he teaches with his fingers. Or literally, he points with his fingers. And this probably refers to blaming, accusing, slandering. He's taking the place of Satan, Diabolos, the accuser. The great accuser. Verse 14. Perverseness is in his heart. He devises mischief continually. He sows discord. So that's what happens to a wicked person. He has fallen to that deceitful thing of spreading and partaking of negative. always tearing down. Always tearing down. And see, people don't realize that when they take on a negative, blaming, accusing attitude, they end up in the part of the wicked. And they really don't realize that. And there are, like it says here, the wicked sows discord. Well, it mentions a brother who sows discord as one of the things that God hates. And you can actually have a brother becoming a wicked person without them even realizing it. Without them even realizing it. Just like the slander against the church in the newspaper. I'm sure that there are probably brethren that contributed that when they saw it come out in the paper the way it came, they were embarrassed and ashamed. They said things that were twisted around and used even, you know, in ways that they didn't want them used. And they find themselves partnering with wicked men, and they don't realize it. They find themselves partnering with wicked men. One has to be careful of what he does. Verse 15. Therefore shall his calamity come suddenly. Suddenly shall he be broken without remedy. Now, broken without remedy is a phrase used elsewhere pointing to the judgment one receives who will not repent. When there's no remedy, it's because they would not repent. For instance, in Proverbs 29:1, it says, he who is often reproved but hardens his neck shall suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy. And there comes a time when he said, no, 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 for the last time, and it comes, and it's just too late. It also mentions that in 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 and 3, about their judgment that lingers not, and their damnation that slumbers not. It's talking about the false prophets and the false teachers. It's a great judgment, this judgment without remedy. And you can see that God hates those that hate others. And one who hates his brother, or one who hates mankind and hates his brother, abides in death, it says in 1 John. Let me give you some other scriptures about the wicked man. I'm just going to list them off real quickly and then just tell you the phrase. So you probably want to get down the reference, and then if you can put down any points after that, that'd be good. Chapter 16, verse 27. He digs up evil. I mean, he doesn't leave anything covered. He hunts for things to dig up. 19 and verse 28. The wicked man is a scorner. He scorns. Chapter 11 and verse 7. The hope of the wicked man perishes. Their hope perishes. What they long for is not going to come to pass. You see, they dig a pit and they fall into it themselves. Chapter 4 and verse 19. The way of the wicked man is darkness. 4:19. Chapter 5 verse 22. His own sin destroys him. And boy, if that isn't the case, the wicked man, the very thing that he uses as sin against others, destroys himself. You know, it's important for us to realize this, that if we have demons in us that lash out at others, like I was dealing with in deliverance with this one guy that just had this spirit of just, it was an ugly thing. He hated it, bad as anybody did. This ugly thing that would rise up in him and just want to kill somebody, you know what I mean? And, well, I tell you, the Lord showed me so clearly, what that demon wants to kill is him. That's who was getting killed, because this brother, of course, wouldn't touch anybody. But this spirit would rise up, and then who it was killing was him. These spirits of accusation, you know who they end up killing? The person that's got them. Blame, attack, they end up destroying the person that has them, you know? And, you know, that's what they're often like. And so, here we see it. His own sin destroys him. Chapter 9 and verse 7. The wicked man will not accept rebuke. He doesn't want it. He won't listen to it. He says, don't give it to him. Chapter 10 and verse 11, violence is in his mouth. He loves violence. He wants to stir things up. He's a wicked man. Chapter 10 and verse 7, his name shall rot. That's a kind of strong statement, but it's true. His name shall rot. God will not have him in remembrance. Chapter 10 and verse 20, his heart has little worth. That one sends a chill down my spine. The thought that your heart would have little worth, I mean, that's who you are. I mean, your heart, I mean, you know, that it would have little worth. Well, that's the place of the wicked. He's a Belial, the worthlessness. Chapter 11 and verse 8, he ends up in the trouble that you get delivered out of. He falls into the trouble that you get delivered out of. So the net that you come out of, he falls into. Chapter 13 and verse 5, he's loathsome and he comes to shame. Men and God don't like the wicked man. He's loathsome, and he comes to shame. Chapter 21, verse 29, he hardens his face. The wicked man, he won't repent. He hardens his face. He won't turn.
In chapter 28 and verse 1, he flees when no man pursues. The wicked man has terrors round about. There are many other scriptures about the wicked man. Just to kind of sum up some things. Everything the wicked man does is cursed. It causes trouble. It's hated by God. It's loathed by man. And the fruit of it crushes them on their own head. So, don't be a wicked person. All right, I'm going to just mention real quickly about the righteous man. We could spend a couple, 3 hours on the righteous man, all the scriptures. There are so many of them. First of all, let's look at a couple of the words that are used to describe the righteous man. The righteous man, first of all, has a very unique place with the Lord. Chapter 3 and verse 32. For the perverse is abomination to the Lord, but his secret is with the righteous. You know, the Lord's secret is with the righteous. His secret counsel, his intimate sharing is with the righteous. The Lord finds fellowship in the righteous. Now here the word for righteous is yashar, and it means upright. In fact, it's often translated upright. It literally means straight and even. Straight and even. And that's why it's often translated upright, because like a fir tree that's straight and even, it's upright. And so this is the idea behind the word yashar, straight and even. He's not deviating. He's not crooked. Isn't that interesting that a crook is a thief? But I don't want to go straight. I mean, we still use the same terms that they used clear back there in the Old Testament. Because we look in this room. The lines in this room are all straight. In fact, if you saw that Moody, you know, in construction and things, you saw that Moody film on the eye and how you see with the mind and not the eye. And I don't know about you, but when they had that little room that's all off on angles and everything, and you look at that thing and and it's not trick photography or anything, but that guy over here just looks like he grows and he gets smaller. And all it is the angles of that thing. And our mind views everything as square, but it's not square. And so when you step back and look at that little room, the thing was all kittywampus. And you're looking straight at the room. But when you get the camera right up into the room, it looks like you're over in a corner looking at the room. But you're not. You're right in the middle of it. But it's because of how they made the windows at a weird angle. And your mind won't let you see that. And so when this guy looks in there, he's big here and small there, and it's just all weird in your mind. But it isn't. It's not any trick photography at all. It's just taking a picture just like it always does. It's just that normally when one guy is way down there and one's up here, he'll be bigger, of course, and he'll be smaller. But in that case, the lines of the room are going to, show that. But because they made the room weird, it looked like the window was straight across, and he was just smaller than he was. And your mind can't reinterpret that, see? And it's so hard to do. The point I'm getting at is that all through history, that which is straight and even is righteous. And that which is crooked and deviating is ungodly. That straightforward, that honesty and clarity. And that doesn't mean that Jesus wasn't... That doesn't mean that Jesus didn't use some things that are pretty tricky sometimes. Be wise as serpents, like the parable. And like some of the statements he made, they misunderstood him totally. And he made like he was going to go by, and he kind of played with the disciples a little bit. And he tested them and all of this. That's wisdom. But this upright attitude. Now the most common word for righteous is tzedak. And T-Z-A-D-A-K. And it means to be right or to be just. To be righteous. To be right. To be just. And that word tzedak is used over 50 times in the Proverbs. And it refers to a man who chooses right, and he loves right, and he lives right. He wants to do right. He's a righteous man. He cares about what is right. Now, I'm not going to give you any references, because there's so many of them. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read off conclusions of what the righteous man is like. And you can write some of these down, or you can just listen. And I'll tell you, by the time we're done, you'll see that this is exactly what you want to be. The righteous man. This is a description of the righteous man from the Proverbs. He's blessed. He's obedient. He's submissive to correction. He won't be famished because God won't allow it. He won't be forgotten. He'll endure forever. His words bring life. His works bring life. His words teach many, and they are precious before God, and they are costly in this world. His desire will be given him. He has great hope. He will never be removed. He speaks wisdom. He speaks only what is acceptable. He's delivered out of trouble. His blessing is another's joy. He shall flourish. He'll receive great reward. He thinks correctly. He's considerate of his animals. No devastating evil shall come upon him. He hates lies. He loves rejoicing. He receives the wealth of the wicked. He is satisfied in this life. He has hope also of eternal life. There's no sorrow in his death. He has much treasure in his house. He meditates before he gives an answer. He's heard when he prays. Hey, you know, all this sounds pretty wonderful to me. He trusts in the name of Yahweh. He walks in his integrity. He wisely considers and discerns the house of the wicked. He enjoys doing justice. He gives and he spares not. Though he falls 7 times, he'll always rise up again. He's as bold as a lion. Those he rules over rejoice in it. He sings and rejoices. He considers the poor. And the unjust man is an abomination to him. You know, it pays to walk with God. It pays to walk with God. It pays to do the will of God. That's the righteous man. Okay, let's go to the 8th class of person, and that's the talebearer. The talebearer. There's 2 Hebrew words that are translated talebearer. One of them, I don't need to give it to you, nirgan is what it is though, but it means literally to roll to pieces. To roll to pieces. And it's translated sometimes whisperer, sometimes slanderer, sometimes talebearer. But it's a strong concept in the Hebrew, to roll to pieces. And it gives the idea of what a whisperer does. He busts things up. He's a talebearer, a whisperer, a slanderer. The more common word, rakil, comes from the root meaning literally to travel for trading. To travel for trading. He's a talebearer. He goes around and he's got all these tales that he trades. Hey, I got a neat story about, you know, so-and-so. Which one, you know, and so who can tell the biggest story? You know? It's like going and some of the kids at, little kids will sometimes do this. Little girls get in their little group and they're talking about all the other ones and, you know, they've got their tale to trade. Talebearer. Carries tales around. Now the first word has, of course, the more negative connotations. Real strong. To roll into pieces. We find it a few places, not very many. Let me give you a few. Chapter 16 and verse 28. A perverse man sows strife, and a whisperer separates chief friends. In other words, those that were chief friends, those that were once real intimate, the roller to pieces, the whisperer, the slanderer, he'll even separate them. So what does this tell you? No matter how close your relationship, it can be destroyed. It can be destroyed by lies, by whispering, talebearing, slander. Chapter 18 and verse 8. The words of a talebearer, this is the one that rolls to pieces. The words of a talebearer are as wounds, and they go down into the innermost parts of the belly. Now the word wounds here is not a good translation. Mothram translates it dainties. And he has a note. Bits greedily swallowed. Dainties. They're bits that are greedily swallowed. You know, when you... I'll have to admit, my bit greedily swallowed is probably that homemade almond roca. At least that's what comes to mind right now. The words of a tattler, is how Rotheram translates it, a tattler, are dainties. That is, bits greedily swallowed. They go down into the chambers of the inner man. There is something about the carnal nature of man that loves to swallow down those negative little statements. You heard about Pastor Don lately? What about Pastor Don? Well, bits greedily swallowed. You heard about that Ashley Young? Ooh, Ashley Young. Really? Bits greedily? Why is it that we're like that? Yuck. That's horrible. Bits greedily swallowed. It shouldn't be that way. You heard the latest news? Inquirer is a whisperer.
Yes.
You know? I don't read it. I've never read it. I suppose maybe I've looked at it once or twice, but I that thing makes me sick. You go through the grocery line and you look. Garbageville. Here you got all this nice food out here, packaged, sanctified, cleansed, kosher food out here, you know, except for the pig meat and all that. And then you come up front and here's this Garbageville.
Yeah.
Filth, just fomenting its filth, just icky junk, rotten, moldy stuff, drippy, oozy filth all over the counter. Yuck. I went behind a woman just the other day. She had Inquirer and a couple of others, all of those junk. You know, I just thought, that poor woman, feeding her mind with filth. And that's what they are. They're bits greedily swallowed. And they go down to the chambers of the inner man. See, that carnal man loves to know negative about somebody else. So as soon as something gets known, out it goes. Greedily swallowed up. I tell you, our people are loving to talk about the chapel right here lately. Bits greedily swallowed. Ooh, did you read the latest? You know. It says the same thing also in chapter 26, verse 22. Same thing, repeated. And so that lets you know that when you get around something like that and you just want to hear it, shut your ears. Shut your ears. There's a whisperer standing in front of you. There's a tattler. There's one who's going to roll you to pieces. Because invariably, it's not... You don't get it straight. Invariably, as soon as something negative comes up about somebody, you don't get it straight. So don't receive negative accusations against people. Believe the best of them, you know? Just go your way. And then even if you see somebody doing something really negative or wrong, believe the best of their heart. You know? And just give them the benefit of the doubt. Chapter 26 and verse 20. Where no wood is, there the fire goes out. So where there's no talebearer, the strife ceases. Talebearer, here's one, rolling to pieces. The strife ceases when he's gone. He creates such strife. Gets people at one another because they're thinking all these negative things of one another. It's horrible. The bearer of these negative dainties that the flesh man loves to devour in order to exalt himself and to forget about his own weaknesses blows up himself and blows up others. And he blows up others' weaknesses. So that's who this roller to pieces is. He loves to bear about these negative dainties that the flesh man loves to devour, and he does it to exalt himself, to put down his own weaknesses, and to exalt others' weaknesses. Now, that other word, rakiel, simply means a tail bearer, one who carries tails, and we only find it twice in the Proverbs. Chapter 11 and verse 13. A tale bearer reveals secrets, but he that is of a faithful spirit conceals the matter. He reveals secrets. You know, there are secrets. There are secrets that need to be kept. A tale bearer, you can't trust him. You can't trust him. He reveals secrets. He loves, it's just too good to tell. It's just too good. Chapter 20, verse 19. It's the other case. He that goes about as a tale bearer reveals secrets. Therefore, meddle not with him that flatters with his lips. And so a person that flatters, that's one of the signs that he may be a talebearer. He loves to say things without his full heart behind it. That's what flattery is. His full heart is not behind it. He can't be trusted.
Tail-bearing was forbidden by the law of God. In Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 16, it says, "Let there be no tail-bearer going up and down among the people." Don't bear tails. Forget it. If a brother sins, go to him and you alone. And if he repents, forgive him and forget it. Tell you, this thing has got to get wiped out from the Church of Jesus Christ. We've got to be more careful with one another. Now, it's not the same Hebrew word, but it's we see something about the same idea in chapter 17 and verse 9. "He that covers a transgression seeks love, but he that repeats a matter separates very friends." Just don't repeat those things. Cover them. And we're talking about transgression. If you're seeking love, start covering. If you want love, start covering. If you want love to build, cover. That's what love does. You manifest love, you receive love. So cover. Don't bring those things out. Cover them. Don't repeat the matter. Very definitely, the man's biggest problem is his tongue. And throughout this Proverbs, those of you that have done the study on the tongue, you can see that it's a real major theme. And it's found all over the place. Now, I just want to throw in a few scriptures at this juncture about the tongue being the problem, the main problem with man. Chapter 18, verse 21. "Death and life are in the power of the tongue. And they that love it shall eat the fruit thereof." You love spreading death, you'll eat death. You love spreading life, you'll eat life. If you love repeating negative things, you'll eat it. You know, and one of the things that often causes people to do it is they want to justify themselves. So how do they justify themselves? Putting somebody else down. "Yeah, but you..." There we go. You are loving death. You'll eat the fruit of it. You're loving talking death. And death and life are in the power of the tongue. That's a killing statement. Accuse, accuse, accuse. That's a killing statement. And if you speak that death, you will eat that death. No, we got to wise up. If we will speak life and speak things that are edifying and encouraging and comforting, we will eat life. We eat the fruit of what we give out through our mouth. Power of life and death is in it. Chapter 13, verse 3. "He that keeps his mouth keeps his life, but he that opens wide his lips shall have destruction." The tongue will get you into problems quicker than by anything else. He that keeps his mouth keeps his life, and he keeps his foot out of his mouth too. You know, you've heard of that. Hoof and mouth disease. "You'll know a fool by his many words." We saw that earlier when we talked about the fool. "You'll know him because of all the talking he does." Chapter 21, verse 23. "Whoso keeps his mouth and his tongue keeps his soul from troubles." You want to stay out of trouble? Then shut your mouth. You want to keep out of trouble? Watch your tongue. Watch what you're saying. If you're under a negative impression, don't talk. If you're under a negative damp, under a negative frame of mind, close the lips. Count to 10. Bite the lip. You know, do what you have to do. Bite the tongue. Chapter 10, verse 19. "In the multitude of words there wants not sin, but he that refrains his lips is wise." Now those of you that are backward, introverted, and shy, don't use this as a hiding place. Because the righteous man uses his words as a tree of life. They're a well of life. "But in the multitude of words there wants not sin." Eventually, if you're a talker, you're going to sin. I mean, it's in our words that we so often stumble. And you're probably familiar with James chapter 3 and verse 2, and it says, "Brethren, we often are stumbling, one and all. But if any offend not in word, he is a perfect man, able to bridle his own body." When you can control your tongue, you can control anything. When you can control your tongue, you can control anything. You can control your whole life. In James chapter 1 and verse 26, it says, "If there be a righteous man among you, and bridleth not his tongue." How does that go? "If any man among you seem to be religious, but bridles not his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is in vain." James 1:26. His religion is vain if he doesn't bridle his tongue. You know, you can just be walking with God and all of this, but if you spout off all that negative filth, and you know others around you, your religion was in vain. God can learn to control that thing. In chapter, 12 and verse 13, the wicked is snared by the transgression of his lips, but the just shall come out of trouble. And it's the lips of the wicked that snares him. And so there needs to be, it's telling us where it's at. This is where it's at. If you can control your tongue, you can control your mind and your heart. And you'll bring the thing under dominion. You'll bring the thing under dominion. Okay, the ninth category of person is the practical joker. A couple points on him. The practical joker, chapter 26, verses 18 and 19. As a madman who casts firebrands, arrows, and death, so is the man that deceives his neighbor and saith, am not I in sport? You know the guy that came into McDonald's and shot a bunch of people? How many did he kill? 18 or something? He killed a whole bunch of people? That's like a practical joker. Because a practical joker, you know, like that one time that the seniors took out a freshman in college and tied him on some railroad tracks, and the train wasn't coming by on his tracks, it was coming by on the one next to him. The kid was so scared he died of a heart attack. They killed him. Practical jokers. Lots of fun. They used to do practical jokes on them, like they'd lay them out on the football field, tilt their head back, take raw eggs, pop them and just drop them down their gullet, and like some guy practically choked to death. And I mean, all this crazy stuff. Practical jokes. You know, you come home and they got blood strewn all over the place and a body, it looks like a body is hanging there with limbs chopped off, and you come inside and then you practically die, and then it was all a joke and they laugh. You'll never forget that impression. Or if somebody comes running out to you and says, your baby died. And the terror falls upon you and they say, just kidding. Practical joker. He's a madman casting firebrands and arrows. There's no place for it. There is no place for it. You know, even the guy that stands behind the door and you walk by and go, boom! Practical joker. That right there can frighten you so bad that your heart just goes, boom, 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 boom. You know? And ha-ha, all joke. It didn't save you from that fear. It didn't save you from all that fright that you went through. It's not good. Those practical jokes are not good. Now, if they know that you're waiting there, that's something different. They don't know that you're waiting, you know. They know that you're waiting, then that's something different. You know how first impressions last? Now, first impressions are the lasting ones. Often this is the case. And so the shock that you got when you thought a certain thing happened hardly leaves. It's hard for that to ever go away. And there's a pain and a fright that you experience that you'll probably never lose. And it was a joke. See? There's no place for it. Just totally wipe it out. In chapter 10 and verse 23, it says, it is as sport to a fool to do mischief, but a man of understanding has wisdom. It's a sport to a fool to do mischief. It's foolishness. It's the opposite of wisdom, so forget it. Just don't do it. Okay, let's talk about women for a bit. Let's talk about a first class of women. This is the tenth class of person. The next three classes are going to be women. Let's talk about the pretty but foolish woman. Chapter 11 and verse 22. As a jewel of gold in a swine's snout, so is a fair woman which is without discretion. Fairness to a woman is a jewel. It's a blessing. It is a blessing. You know, it's not a curse. It is a blessing. But if she doesn't have discretion, that is, if she doesn't make discrimination, it's like a jewel of gold in a swine's snout. What does he think about that? What does that swine do with that ring of gold? He just jams right into the muck along with everything else. You ever seen a pig eat in the muck? He'll jam his head way down in there so it's buried in all this slop. He will. He'll just jam his head right down in. I was around pigs before. And they go after that stuff. They throw that slop out in 2 foot of mud. And the pig will just jam his head right down into the mud where you can't see his head at all. And he loves it. You know, and if he had a jewel of gold in his snout, would he keep it clean? Oh, got to keep it clean? No way. He'd jam it right into the mud along with everything else. It's right up there where everything gets filthy and muddy, right on his snout. And A woman who trusts in her beauty will not gain discretion, and she'll end up just like that. If she trusts in her beauty, instead of learning to be wise and learning to judge things and learning to weigh things, she will become just like that. And it's a shame. Chapter 31 and verse 30. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Beauty is vain because in itself it does not bring what life is needed, what is needed in life, excuse me. What is needed in life? The fear of the Lord. Beauty, and as a matter of fact, can be very distracting from the fear of the Lord because it is constantly being applauded and sought after. And the temptation, therefore, would be to receive the security and the self-worth from an external, transitory thing instead of receiving your self-worth from the fear of the Lord. Okay, let's look at the 11th class of person, and that's the nagger. This is also a woman. It's interesting to me that four times this particular statement is repeated in the Proverbs. Four. And that's a universal number. Okay, chapter 21, verse 9. It is better to dwell in a corner of the housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. This brawling woman is a woman of contentions. A contentious woman. Look at verse 19. It is better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and an angry woman. Chapter 19, verse 13. A foolish son is a calamity of his father, and the contentions of a wife are a continual dropping. And chapter 27 and verse 15. A continual dropping in a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. It's miserable. It's torture. And you see, the thing about the dropping is from the custom of how their homes were made. How they made their homes is they put beams across the rock walls. And then they'd lay cross branches from that were lighter and smaller. And then, you know, twigs and then sometimes leaves. And then they'd put sometimes gravel or dirt and then gravel. And then they'd roll it. And after each rain, they'd roll it again. And it'd keep getting harder. And they'd throw lime up there. And if they had some salt, they might throw it up there. After a while, it'd get pretty hard. And then sometimes even sod would grow. But if it rained and it broke through with a leak, you don't go up there and patch it. Can you imagine what would happen on a wet roof if you got up on a wet roof? You'd fall through. You'd make 10,000 leaks. So if it starts to leak, you can't touch it. You gotta let it drip. You see, the Bible doesn't say knock her down a rabbit hole. It's giving honor to the woman. But there's a temptation in women because of their position, their subordinate position under the man. Once she's made her needs known, instead of just forgetting it and submitting, then temptation is to make her need known again. And again. Now see, she's not the man. She can't make the decision. But she can sure needle and pressure to try to get her way. And that's the temptation. And he's not going to just wring her neck. You know, he's not going to throw her out of the house. I mean, she's a fellow human being, but because of her position, she can become a continual nagging. A continual nagging, a continual contention, and it will absolutely drive the man out of his mind. Have you ever had a drip, drip, drip in your bathroom, you know, sink, and you couldn't get it fixed and it just kept dripping and dripping? You finally went in there and put a cloth underneath, and then it soaked up, and then it clunk, clunk, clunk. You know, you about drive, you're nuts, and you're being tortured to death. And you possibly heard that one of the Chinese tortures is to lay a man, strap him down, and then slowly drip water on his forehead. And after about 2 days of that, they'll drive the person insane. He'll go insane. A woman can drive her husband insane if she's not submissive. And it's mentioned four times. So, let me just say this. There's a better way to let your needs get known. Let your need be known, just like you do to the Lord. Honor your husband in it. And if you let him be the man and make the decision instead of needling, you'll get your way better. You'll get your way better, and he'll listen to your needs better than if you try to force him, because he being the man making the decision, when that pressure comes, it makes him want to bristle all the more against it. And so what have you got? You've got kind of a situation that you know, about the only thing you can do is just get out of the house. Go out and live in the wilderness for a while. Get on the housetop. Do something, you know. Get away from that constant dripping. So, women, word to the wise. All right, the next class of women is the virtuous woman. And there's more scriptures on the virtuous woman. Praise the Lord. The virtuous woman, chapter 12 and verse 4. This is the 12th class of person we've talked about now. Chapter 12 and verse 4. A virtuous woman is a crown to her husband, but she that makes ashamed is as rottenness in his bones. Virtuous, literally in the Hebrew, a force. This word is really interesting in the Hebrew, virtuous. It means a force. And it sometimes is translated army, and, you know, as a force. It sometimes is used to refer to a person's resource, like his money, wealth. Is sometimes therefore used to refer to wealth. It can refer to character though also, like it does here. And so a woman of deep character, she's got a lot in her. You know? She's a force. She's virtuous. And she's a crown to her husband. You know, like Jenny Okers. That's right, there's force, resource, there's means, there's character, there's depth.
Yeah.
There's a lot in there that will constantly be coming out and being a blessing to the man's life. That's a virtuous woman. And there's many things said about her. We'll get into that tomorrow. A few more classifications of people, and then I'm going to cover some important categories of teachings, and then we'll be done with Proverbs, believe it or not. Your assignments are due Friday, right? A week from this Friday? I thought it was Friday. Is it a week from this Friday?
25th.
It's the 25th. Well, the Lord will provide.